Right, good morning to all. After a one-week break, we'll be continuing today shortly, just in a few moments, with today's class. We'll be continuing our theme of understanding the Chumash, understanding the Torah by taking another verse and reviewing the actual written words to see exactly the message that we can derive just from the text itself. You know, again, we'll just start in 1 or 2 minutes.
Rabbi.
Good morning, Cal.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Hey, Doug, how are you?
Doing okay. How about yourself?
All right. How'd everything work out?
It's been going so far okay.
All right.
It's been an interesting week.
Yeah. I'd mentioned to Rabbi Mann, I saw him over the weekend. He wasn't even aware.
Oh, my. You know, I had talked to him, but I guess I talked to him while Dad was still alive, and I forgot to let him know. Ugh. A little slip.
Yeah.
Do you know if his daughter had her baby yet?
Yes, she did. They had, I believe it was 2 weeks ago, they had the bris last week.
Ah.
I think Wednesday.
Wow.
Yes, it had. It's the third boy now. So I told him, you know, keep going. You're halfway to matching my parents. I'm one of six brothers.
Six brothers.
Yeah.
Wow.
I'm sure Shia's wife was very excited at the prospect of doubling her litter.
I can imagine.
Okay.
Ay-yi-yi.
Any questions come up? Any issues?
Let's see. I don't think so.
No. I was just thinking that I had once written an article regarding honoring parents, and it's even subsequent after the pass. So you can probably find it on the site under, if you look at the words honoring parents, something like that. So just in terms of things that are apropos now, they'll probably, you know, maybe more appreciated by you, and maybe they'll register as you know, having more meaning. I know that, you know, when things come in a timely fashion, so then it actually does present like more of a deeper meaning to us. So I think it's based on Maimonides' words. And again, you know, whenever he writes, he's always hinting to something greater. He follows, I think Rabbi Chait said, he follows the style of the Torah, that just enough information is given, and then you have to dig, you know, extrapolate, and deduce and induce from what's going on.
And so he was talking about obligations that extend beyond their lives. Does that go beyond the things that are customarily Jewish, like yahrzeit and that sort of thing?
Yeah, he was talking about specifically one example that I recall from the article was that you honor the your parents, let's say your father, by mentioning his name when you refer to something that he taught you.
Okay.
You address him, you get respect. I know when he's alive, you don't sit in his chair, but call him by his first name, and I'm sure that calling the first name is also applicable even afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an interesting phenomenon that I believe you'll see there's a distinction between parents and judges in terms of cursing, whether the prohibition of cursing comes in. I believe it's more specific when it talks about cursing a judge. I think there it has the prohibition in the Torah where it says don't do it, and then it also has the punishment, and if you do it, this is the punishment. Whereas by the parents, I believe it's just that it says that whoever curses the parents, I think it's actually in yesterday's Parsha, but it doesn't have the initial warning in the Torah, which is interesting. It's definitely a purposeful omission. It would seem to target the idea that the greater authority figure is the judge, because that's really in terms of the system of Torah, whereas the parent is in terms of the biological. And the real, you know, the whole question comes up as to why, you know, the Ten Commandments, sort of broken up the two parts. The first five of the Ten Commandments are between man and God, and the second five are between man and man. And I don't know, do we ever discuss that? The order that they go in as well within each set of five?
Yeah, we have.
Right.
I don't know that we've done it in this class.
The order
to review it.
Yeah, the order is in a hierarchy. The most important command comes first with each set. So
for example,
like between man and God, so the first law is to know God exists, second is not to accept other gods. The third is not to use his name in vain. So the first two have to do with thought. Acceptance in your mind about who, you know, what God is. And the second one, which is also thought, is to deny or reject any other gods. The third one has to do with speech, that you shouldn't use God's name in vain. The fourth one is keeping the Sabbath, which is action. And the fifth one is honoring parents, which is also action. So it goes from thought, speech, to action. Those are, the rabbi said, the only three activities a person can partake of is either thinking, speaking, or acting. And in connection with God, the most important is your ideas of God, not so much what you say or do. So the most important are mentioned first. That's why it's the areas of thought, knowing what God is, and rejecting in your mind any other God. But between laws of man and man, how you think about it, your fellow, you know, is not as important as what you do. So that's why the first law and the second set of the Ten Commandments is don't kill. Then it's don't have adultery, and then don't kidnap. Those are all actions. Then it says don't swear falsely. You give false testimony in courts. That's speech. And the last one is not to desire, not to covet, which is a thought. So it's the reverse order, because the more important medium in terms of keeping a society established is the physical interaction between people, not their thoughts. Which is a very nice idea. You see how there's really a system just to those Ten Commandments themselves. And the Rabbi Sadia Gaon says those actually are the head categories for all the remaining commands in the Torah. But what's interesting is that in the first five, which is between man and God, the question comes up, why is there the law of honoring your parents? That sounds like a law between man and man.
Isn't it because as a child, your first sense of authority is your parents, and then that, as they get older, that helps you recognize the authority of God.
Exactly. It targets the goal of God, so that's why it's there. Even though practically it is between man and man, but that is exactly right. That's the whole objective. And but it's interesting, it could be also that since judges are also an authoritative role, but they're now an authoritative role regarding the Torah, so it's more closely tied to the real target of accepting God, whose the whole relationship is to follow his Torah. So it's more severe when you curse a judge as opposed to cursing a parent. So there, that would explain why the Torah would include the prohibition, don't curse a judge, and also the punishment, and if you curse the judge, this is your punishment. Whereas with parents, it would only say, this is the punishment, but it doesn't say don't. Because if it did, then it would be equating parents to judges, which is not true. There's a different role that parents have in terms of a person's approach to God, where the judges who uphold the system are more closely tied to the real objective. So the Torah indicates that by giving more severity in the verses to the judge than to the parents. A lot of different angles that the Torah teaches, not just the, you know, the meaning of the words, but omissions. It's interesting. Do we ever discuss the two verses of witchcraft being aligned right next to bestiality?
No, we did not.
Okay, good. Because that was in yesterday's Parsha, and that's the question. Another way that the Torah teaches us is there's certain what we call parshios, or segments, isolated areas in the Torah, and they're offset. If you look in the actual written Torah, you'll see that you'll have a whole bunch of text. You know, there's no punctuation, there's no vowels under the letters, there's no commas, and so on and so forth. So one word would then be separated merely by a gap of one letter space, and then you have another word. And the entire Torah is like that, except when you come to a break of nine letter gap, which is maybe a few inches. Now you know that you just finished one subject matter, and God's telling you with that gap of letters that now a new area is starting. And that area can go on for a while, or it can go on for a few verses. And that's the case here, where in Mishpatim is talking about all the statutes that God gave to Moshe and brought down to the people on Sinai. And one of them that caught my eye was, just on the surface, what do they have to do with each other? It says, if you look in the Torah, you'll be reading all the words. It'll be talking, I'll tell you the exact verse, if you're looking together. It's Exodus 22:17 and 18. Exodus 22, verses 17 and 18. And okay. So tell me when you have it.
Okay, hang on just a second.
I saw in an email, next week you're not going to be around, right?
Right.
Okay, so we'll pick up 2 weeks from today, all right?
Okay, got it.
Okay, so I'll just read the verses because Josh and JHS are online, so I'm not sure if you guys have the text. I'll just read it. It says, a witch you should not let live, and the commentaries say clearly that it applies to a warlock as well. It's just that women have more of a tendency towards superstitiousness. So, I'm not sure if superstitiousness is a word, but I use it anyway. And therefore, the Torah speaks in the common common cases. So there's more of an inclination, so therefore they say a witch. But the rabbis say clearly, if a man also performs any type of magic, presenting himself as a warlock, also he has to be killed. So that's the first verse. And then it says, anybody who lies with an animal, meaning a person commits bestiality, he also must be killed. And you see the beginning of 17, right before that, there's a samach. There's a Hebrew letter samach, which means it's a gap. And after the second verse, at the end of 18, you see there's another samach, another gap. So that's offsetting these two verses as being their own area. That means there has to be a common theme. So the question is, what is the common denominator between these two things? They sound completely far afield. So the question is, what steps do we take?
Well, it would seem like we would have to ask some appropriate questions.
Yes.
I started at the very beginning.
That's right.
Trying to figure out what is the key question to ask that would open up the answer. I mean, first question that comes to my mind is, what is, I guess, what is unique about these that they have in common? And the answer seems to be that they're not somehow in alignment with the natural order of things. But that's too vague.
What do you mean, that in line with the natural order?
Well, aligning with the beast is certainly not in line with the natural order of the way God intended man to live.
Right. Well, homosexuality also would not be in line with natural order.
Well, that's true, and I suppose somebody who wanted to counter-argue my argument could say, so what's not natural about it?
Right.
And should we be asking the question here exactly what is a witch?
That's one of them.
Yes, for sure. You first have to define the terms, right?
Yeah, I mean, we understand what beast, the aligning with the beast means, but what exactly is, how does the Torah define a witch?
Well, the Torah defines it as people who claim to produce cause and effect, and to borrow Rabbi Chait's definition, without any causal relationship. Like, a causal relationship is if I take a rock and I throw it at the window, I can't say, you know, magic, I broke the window, because nature explains why the window broke. But if I just move my hand and the window breaks, so now it's disjointed. There's no natural law that could explain. So if I do this and somehow I rig up an ultra-high sound that nobody could hear, and I have it on a button next to my foot, and nobody's looking at my foot because I'm using my hand to distract them, and then I move my hand and I step on that button that hits the ultra-high frequency and smacks the window, now it's like, wow. So if a person does that, so then he would be considered a witch or a warlock.
So, it's not just someone who is actually claiming they really have power. The definition includes someone who knows that they don't, but is being purposely deceptive.
Yes.
Interesting.
Yeah,
when they talked about the magicians during Moshe's time, would they be considered warlocks?
Yes.
And I presume that today's stage magicians would not, because it's generally known that it's all deception and sleight of hand done only for entertainment?
That's right. Unless people come up with, like, they're now, I think a deviation from that, that they try to claim truth, is the psychics. They're trying to say there's something intellectual going on over here, mind reading. So it might be a problem in that case, Although we have to really get down to, you know, specifics. What is the difference here between which and what's not? And JHS is saying that the person takes credit for power outside of God. Yeah, I would say that's true also.
Well, what about, with regard to that, what about someone who claims they have some prophetic gift but claims that God gave it to them?
Well, if it's if he's lying, he gets killed. The Torah says openly a false prophet is killed. But that would be a separate violation. Here, it seems to be manipulation. What a witch or a warlock does is a manipulation of some objects. Like for, I looked around to see if the rabbis had a definition. I only found one, and they said that the Adoni and the means that the person who takes like a, like that case was according to the Rambam, a person would take the bone of a bird called a yudua, and he would put it in his mouth, and he'd make believe he's like speaking or chanting, or he would be doing certain things, and then that now was going to be giving forth new information or I'm not sure if it was telling him about the future. Or would say that now you'll be successful now that I did this. They'd fall on the floor in a trance as if they were like getting some new insights, some tapping into some world of knowledge. I mean, they all come. All these practices are popular even today because people are insecure and they're looking for something clear about what's going to happen in the future. They don't want to face life, you know, with the courage that a healthy human being should. Now, yeah, go ahead.
No, I'm still pondering how to connect those two.
All right, yeah, think for a moment. Think about what other questions you might ask over here that would just pave the way a bit.
Well, I guess one would be in either case. So, okay, you got this person that's doing these deceptive things. Why does the Torah want to kill him?
Right.
I mean, why not just expose them and try to teach them don't do that stuff? And in the same way, okay, someone who's having relations with the beast, yeah, I mean, that kind of grosses us all out and so forth when we think about it, but why is that a capital offense?
Right. Those are important questions.
But what is it that makes those things so?
It seems like the common theme to me would be a deception.
Maybe a deception. Who's a deception for when you have when you commit bestiality?
Well, the deception is the relationship between a man and woman is to procreate, and you can't do that with a beast. And so you're playing into a fantasy or it's a deception.
Well, you could say anything is a deception. I mean, what do you mean it's a deception? Is there somebody else watching that you're deceiving? I don't know what you mean it's a deception.
Well, it seems like by design, man was made to reach pleasure and to procreate with his like kind, man with man, you know, with woman. And to take that to a different species is a deception.
I'm going to counter with you. I'm going to suggest that if you're talking about the pleasure aspect, I mean, if one can get by the psychological implications, you know, a person may still experience pleasure in that, may have no intention of procreating.
Wouldn't it be a fantasy, though? something?
Certainly.
Joshua was just suggesting here, he wants to say, could it be that witchcraft deals with the relationship with God while bestiality deals with the relationship with other people? Could be. I don't see. So what would that answer, Josh? Again, that would seem to break apart the theme, not unite the two. And JHS, you're saying that Hashem is one holy God and they followed the flesh. That's true. That's what they're doing with bestiality. But again, we're trying to ask what the common ground is. I would make one step to start moving towards, again, what you asked was right. The first thing is to define, so we know bestiality, we didn't know what witchcraft was, so now we defined witchcraft were. But I would ask, why both bestiality in the sexual arena and witchcraft in the superstitious arena, why are those singled out? Meaning, what is it in bestiality that does not exist in other sexual deviations like homosexuality, rape, incest, adultery? What is it that bestiality has that those don't have? Now that question will now make us start comparing bestiality to others, and that'll help us refine what it is more. The same thing should be done with witchcraft. Why is witchcraft different than idolatry, bowing down to an idol, or inquiring of the dead? Things of that nature that are in that camp, but that one was also singled out. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because that would be the approach I would start on.
Okay, so...
Hi, Josh, JHS, you see the approach? Cal, you see what I'm doing?
Yeah, I do.
Well, I mean, one obvious thing about bestiality compared to all the other things you named is that between man and beast as opposed to man and man or man and woman.
Okay. What is the... let's see if we define that. So... All right, so let me just repeat it again for JHS. What we're asking over here is in order to find out why the Torah puts together these two sins of witchcraft and bestiality, that means it has to be some sort of common theme. So in order to understand what unique qualities these two things have, we have to really define each one independent to really boil it down to its real definition. What is the unique nature of bestiality? So we can ask, why is that different than all other sexual deviations? Like, why doesn't the Torah put together witchcraft and rape, or witchcraft and adultery? No, the Torah puts together witchcraft and bestiality. So that would force us to ask, what does bestiality have that the other sexual deviations don't have? Okay? All right. You ahead, Doug?
I'm still thinking.
Okay.
Thing I can come up with is that you've got a situation between man and beast as opposed to man and man, because if you argue that, well, it's solely for the purpose of pleasure, not procreation, you can make that argument about homosexuality too.
That's right, so I guess it can't be that.
Well, it can't be that. And if you make the argument that, well, the animal's not a willing partner,
rape isn't.
Rape isn't a willing situation either, so it can't be that.
Right.
And you can't really make the argument, well, it's not normal because, or it, you know, it's against the nature of things because.
homosexuality.
Yeah, homosexuality, and somebody could say, what's not natural about it, you know? But I don't see... So if I just settle for a moment with the ideas between man and beast, it doesn't seem to get me anywhere.
Okay.
Maybe... There's got to be something else.
Yeah.
So if I hold that thought for a minute, and I switch to the other side and look at witchcraft. In witchcraft, we define as somebody who claims to produce cause and effect without any causal relationship. Idolatry is more about trusting in powers other than Hashem, but it doesn't get to a particular person claiming to have those powers.
Right. That's a good step.
And even talking to the dead seems like it's qualitatively different than witchcraft, because a person is just talking and claiming to talk to someone who's a dead person, but not, again, producing any cause and effect without a causal relationship, and taking credit for that power.
Well, let's refine that. Let's say the dead said tomorrow you'd be successful if you, you know, take some cat's hairs and boil them up with bat's wings or something. As opposed, in contrast that, if the witch says the same thing, what's the difference between those two cases?
Because you don't have a living person claiming it. You've got some supposedly dead entity, and the person who is facilitating isn't claiming to have that knowledge or that power.
Ah.
They're just claiming to facilitate.
Ah, there you go. So you just refined it down. You've now made the clear distinction that the witch, as opposed to bowing down to an idol or talking to the dead or any things like that, the witch is now claiming to be the source of the manipulation.
Right. So they claim to have a power that, in some ways, I guess, is equivalent to Hashem.
Or even leave Hashem out of the picture, just that they claim to have the power, as opposed to saying that it's the dead, or it's the idol, or it's the pillars of fire by the Molech, you know, deviation. But all the other cases, you know, if a cat crosses my path, you know, these are all things that are external to the self, whereas the magician or the warlock, no, it's me who's doing it.
Okay.
Now let's go back to the sexual.
Could it have something to do with man exercising power over the beast?
Exercising.
Or dominance?
Dominance. What would be dominance?
That would be kind of in a rape situation, too.
That's true. So it wouldn't be bestiality alone.
Hmm.
So the problem here with the sexual is that I believe it's a subtle thing, and it's not easily seen. Meaning it's not something merely that's physically different. There's something psychologically different here.
Could it be down the path that the person who commits bestiality is essentially saying that I have the right to take whatever animal or whatever object out there and use it for my own sexual pleasure.
Well, that would be rape also.
Yeah, that's true. That's a really good question.
I hope you like the answer.
Yeah.
It's not good if you work all this hard and forget it, then I'll just skip the country for a couple of months.
Good thing we're not meeting next week, huh?
Yeah, give me a time for the
to flee.
You gotta get my passport updated.
Psychological.
Yeah.
Think about what you said about the witchcraft. What's the difference there? You said that the other idolatrous or superstitious types of practices are derived from, or the source is external to the self, right? So it's the ostensible dead voice. It's the idol that I project powers onto. It's the fire that I pass my baby through in Molech. That violation. It's the black cat that crosses my path. It's an unlucky number. It's events that I calculate. If this happens, it's a good sign. If they don't happen, it's a bad sign. But these are all things that function and they exist in the world outside of me, whereas the magician, the warlock, the witch, they're now doing things. They're moving objects around, they're making certain voices. It's them. Now Joshua is writing, you're not serving anyone or anything else. Joshua, what case are you talking about? The sexual or the idolatrous? But the key is going to be, and I think you're saying something, Josh, but just clarify what you're saying. Think about the mindset of the person who commits bestiality as opposed to the other sexual prohibitions. So Josh is saying, he's on the path, Josh. He's saying that in both cases, where a person is a witch or a warlock, or where a person commits bestiality, you're not serving anyone else or anything else. But we have to fine-tune that. We have to fine-tune that. So he's saying further that you're not pleasing another person, and you're not serving any force. That's you just said he's even better now. He said you're not pleasing another person. What does he mean by that, Doug? Cal? In bestiality, you're not pleasing another person. Why is that significant?
Because the entire act is focused on you.
That's
and your pleasure.
Right. Exactly. That's the same thing with witchcraft. In both cases, we're being taught that the Torah takes these two verses and tells us that any witch has to be killed and any person who commits bestiality has to be killed. Because it wants to tie together by what the common bond is. And that common bond, I believe, is that it's the self is now overshadowing all other considerations in life. Life starts with my desires, and then the world is just there to cater to them somehow. As opposed to what God's plan is by giving human beings intelligence, is that we are supposed to be passive. And passive, I mean that we look outside of ourselves and we learn from how the world is designed and what God said, and then we understand what, you know, how the world works And a person doesn't just come to a laboratory one day and takes a bunch of chemicals and mixes them together. He could make the biggest explosion and kill himself. What he does is he studies them all after many years, and when he understands how they work, then he uses them based on his passive observation and studying how the actual world operates. Well, the same thing has to work here in terms of our actions. If a person just starts out by saying, I'm going to be a sexual glutton and this is all life is about, now I'll just try to force the world to satisfy me. So now he's going in the opposite direction of God's plan. This is why the person is killed, because he's not following the most basic theme, the most primary fundamental of using intelligence to observe what the world should be. This person is not observing. This person is now projecting just the opposite. The person is now trying to just, doesn't matter how the world operates. I have a certain agenda, and I'm the only thing that's important. And that's expressed to the height of the sexual by when a person sleeps with an animal. Because then there's not even another object over there. You're not even trying to please another person in the sexual act. Even in rape, there's another person there. There is some reality. But when it comes to an animal, then there is no other personality there. It's just you. It's as if there's not even an animal there. So the focus is purely you. Same thing with witchcraft. You're not claiming that there's an idol out there, or the voice of the dead, or a black cat, or an eclipse that you assume has meaning. No, what you're saying is, I determine what reality is. I'll move this twig around, I'll put this bone of a bird in my mouth and make certain shrieks. And in that case also, the person is now living with the idea that the self is what determines what reality is. You see the common bond?
Yes.
Yeah.
See, it's subtle. By the sexual is very subtle, because you have to, what's the difference over here? So it's an animal, so it's homosexuality. But no, you think about it, there's one major component missing over there. Now, once that's clear, I'll tell you a completely different approach that Rabbi Mann had to this. Press is clear. Everybody sees that? Josh? JHS? Okay, good. Cal, you see it?
Yeah.
Right. Rabbi, just to make sure I've got the point.
Yes.
So, when you're talking about rape then, which I think is also a capital crime, if I recall.
Yes.
But the distinction being that even though you're forcing your own desires and agenda, the fact that there is another person involved has a different aspect of sort of keeping you in reality than a beast.
Yes.
Okay.
There, the crime is, of course, you're forcing, but at least the act itself, see, the act per se is more in line with nature. It is exactly the right, you know, object of intercourse. It's a woman. So it's very interesting. I just found it very, very interesting. Now, Rabbi Mann had a different approach, and he said that what happens in bestiality, which does not occur in the other sexual deviations, is that in the other sexual deviations, the sin, the crime of the person, is that it's a lack of control. Whereas when a person selects an animal, the crime is in a perversion of the act. Right? So there's many ways a person can violate the God system. One could be where he doesn't maintain a certain amount of control. The easiest way to see that is when he has intercourse with his wife when she has her menstrual period. So those 12 days of the month when there's supposed to be separation, he doesn't control himself and he violates that. So that's a very severe punishment. That's kares. That's a cutting off of the soul. It's also seen when you take somebody you're not supposed to take, like your friend's wife. So there, at least the object of the intercourse is a proper object, but the control is where the sin is. As opposed to an animal, there it's not a matter of control. There it's a matter of a perversion of what the act is. And he wanted to say the same thing was the case with witchcraft. You're perverting how the world operates. You're saying I can do certain things, and this is now how the world's going to operate. The only thing is, you could say the same thing about idolatry. So that was his approach. But I think both have merit.
Yeah, they both make sense.
Yeah. And again, it's just from simple alignment of two verses and setting them apart from the verses before or afterwards, indicating to us that there's something here to look at. There's some common bond between these two infractions. So there's many ways that the Torah gives us indications as to what a lesson can be. Since knowledge is something which is endless, so you cannot write it. You can't write it down in its entirety. I mean, there's a limit to the amount of verses that the Torah has. So the way God gets us to penetrate more and more areas of wisdom is by including tremendous amount of hints in the Torah, and that makes us think, and then we enter the world of wisdom, and we start penetrating a very real world of knowledge that can only be seen and unraveled by correct questioning and the correct facts, and using the basic modes of reasoning, induction and deduction. So that's how God forces us into that realm to see even greater knowledge. It's very interesting. You don't have nothing else like that in the world. All right, any questions or comments? Let's take a pause here.
It's an amazing thing that so much is contained in just that tiny little two-verse section.
Yeah. It is. Last time we got together, we discussed the astrologers who couldn't stand before Moses, right? With the boils, we did that?
Right.
Right. Yeah, that too is also very, very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, one verse. Just. And somebody mentioned that you see that it was very successful because you don't see the astrologers mentioned again after that point. So it was successful in terms of completely demoting them and their veneer, their facade, as being any more powerful than the common Egyptian person.
Seems like it would be a really strange occupation to be engaged in fooling a ruler through deception, knowing full well you're doing it. I mean, there are a lot of people involved in false doctrines and false religions and so forth, but I think they truly think they're doing the right thing.
Yeah, like
here you've got a bunch of people who clearly know they're not, and are using, you know, trickery and, you know, chemicals and all and so forth to, unless they're somehow fooling themselves into thinking that they are in fact doing something when all they're doing is using trickery to do it.
Right. Well, I would not be surprised that the person deludes themselves too when they see some semblance of, because a person can predict and maybe you'll get things right, you know, 10% of the time, but with that 10% of the time he gets it right, and he might delude himself, hey, I really do know how to predict. And then he gives excuses for all the other 90% of the time that he's wrong. Yeah, it's similar a little bit, this and that. I mean, the person who wants to, I think they will But it is true what you're saying, that it's a funny thing where a person can just lie to themselves and others. But what do politicians do? They flip-flop all the time when they're losing their ratings. So they realize that they just want to get into office and have that fame, be that president. You know, people have made plenty of money, they're successful, but that's not enough. Now they want to be president. But then they're basically successful because they're feeding on the need of people to have a leader. They want somebody great to follow. That's what the Jews said. Said to Samuel, we want to have a leader like all the other nations. So they didn't ask for it properly. It's okay to have a leader. God created Moses as a leader. But if you don't ask for it properly, if you're just trying to replicate what the alien nations are doing, so then you're not looking for a leader for the proper reasons. A leader should be someone that you're looking for knowledge, for honesty, and someone that you can question and that will admit he's wrong when he is. And that's what Aaron did with Moses. Moses said to Aaron, after his two sons died, said they're supposed to eat of the sacrifice, and they weren't. And Moses was upset with his brother Aaron. And Aaron responded and said, would this be favorable before God? Now that I have had the death of my two sons, and I should be now be having the sacrifice? And Moses then agreed. So Aaron had the intelligent courage to speak up when he felt he was correct. He didn't just blindly accept, which is a very common thing today, where people just blindly accept anything a rabbi tells them. And then it gets into the mystical world. I know this last 2 weeks ago, so there's a man that was some woman called up, you know, one of these matchmakers, and she said that there was a Kabbalistic or a great rabbi who was in town, and he'll give you a blessing and help you get married. So the man's response was, he said two things. First of all, he doesn't know me, so what can he possibly do to help direct me? And number two, there's no prophecy anymore, as the Talmud states, so there's no knowledge that he has straight from God, so this man can't possibly do anything for me. But the matchmaker was like belligerent and kept on pushing. No, he's great. He's the son of a Kabbalistic person who's the son of a Kabbalistic rabbi and this and that. So she couldn't accept that. But the bottom line is that the man was right. That you follow reason, and there's nothing. If the person doesn't know who you are, what type of advice can they give you? What can they make an enchantment, a blessing, and all of a sudden that's going to make a change? And make a change in the world? It's impossible. Words don't have effect on physically on the world.
So, does that mean that these stories that you read of, you know, so-and-so and so-and-so had been trying to have a child for X years and they couldn't, or maybe they just, you know, hadn't tried that long, and they went to so-and-so rabbi who gave them a blessing that they should have a child, and within a year they conceived.
But that could
be all completely false.
They're probably lies. Half the stories, if not 99% of the stories, are not firsthand. I hear these stories a lot, and I say, did you hear this directly? No, I was told by a friend, they said. I said, yeah, that's that's how it always is. It's always somebody made up a story somewhere. It sounded great, and that's why people, you know, pass it down. They keep on transmitting it. But you could explain it naturally, too, that a person's stress that's keeping their body very tense and they can't have kids when they have some sort of ease from it and they believe what the rabbi says, so that can actually have a physical effect, just like tension can give a person diarrhea. I mean, that's something which is a physically proven truth. So if there's a psychological alleviation, so then the person could possibly have a child after that. And then they falsely attribute it to the words of the person. Rabbi Chait was talking about a case in the backward world, pygmy people, where a witch doctor would pronounce a spell on somebody, he's going to die, and he would be strong as an ox, and he would just drop down dead. Why? Because he believed the witch doctor so much as being reality, it frightened the heck out of him, and he had a heart attack. It's explained naturally. But most of these stories are not true at all. Matter of fact, I know firsthand, my friend's wife told me firsthand that her sister had cancer, and she went to one of the biggest rabbis at the time, and which was a mistake, unless you want to ask him to help and to pray, because then, like Rabbi Chaya explained, the prayer of a person, if it really affects him too, God can respond. So although he may not respond to you, but if it's going to have an effect on the other person's life, so God can definitely, you know, respond because of that person. But that wasn't the case. The case was she went to, just to ask, will her sister live? And the rabbi said yes, but she died. And she lost all faith in, I'm not sure all rabbis, but at least this one. But that was because she had a false notion of what rabbis were. She thought rabbis were these, had always right 100% of the time. And they have prophecy and whatever other things that they project onto them. When people are desperate, that's a lot of times their emotions just take over and blind them to reason. But that's not that is not the way of the Torah. Matter of fact, there's a Gemara, there's a portion of the Talmud where Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, you know, a great, great rabbi, so he told his son to go over to Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai's students, that the students should bless him. So what does that mean? Why didn't Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, who was a rabbi, why didn't he bless his own son? And what does it mean to bless somebody anyway? But what that means is, bless means, like when Jacob blessed his sons, if you look at what he said to them, and again to quote Rabbi Chait, he described certain character traits that they had. He showed them things about themselves. Right? The actual words are, I think it says he blessed them in accordance with their blessing, I think is how it says it. Meaning in accordance with their nature, he described, he said to Reuben that you're as impetuous as water, because he was the one that went in and took the bed out of one of the matriarch's tents and put Jacob's bed in his mother's tent. So he was trying to indicate that now that I believe Rachel had died, so now Jacob should be regularly found with Leah, not with, Rachel's midwife. I'm not sure how it goes. But if this is part of the blessing, so it means that the blessing is to show the person things in their nature. So Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai said, it's better off that my students bless my son than I do. Why? Because Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai saw in his students, these two specific students, that they were very objective when it came to personal relationships. And he felt that they would be more appropriate to look into his son's nature and to tell his son about what he needs in life and how to direct him, because maybe Rav Shimon Yochai felt, honestly, he had certain biases towards his son. But it wasn't anything magic. It wasn't, here, go to these guys and they're going to, you know, pronounce a certain incantation and now the world is going to change because of words that they just articulated. That just isn't doesn't help. It's not how it works. Moses tells the people, you can choose good, you can choose bad, you can choose life or death. And he says, no, choose life, meaning it's in your hands. He doesn't say that you can go get a blessing and your fate is going to change.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah.
It's almost like character counseling when you talk about a blessing in that context.
Yes. I mean, unless God gives you a certain prophecy and then you can pass it on. But we're not talking about that anymore. The prophecy just does not exist at this point. It eventually will come back, but in this day and age, it's not there. Any questions or any comments?
None here, I think.
Not here, but can I change the subject?
No, I'm sorry, you cannot. What's the question?
We were talking talking earlier in the week about coming in contact with the dead and with the Levites in the temple.
Right.
When they were doing the sacrifices, they were coming in contact with the dead. Is that different because it was an animal versus a human?
Yes. Yes, Rabbi Mamowitz explained the reason for that, which is a nice idea. And that was that the Levites and the priests are there to lead the people towards a good life, what life is all about. And being in contact with the dead is the opposite of what their role is. They're to teach us the right ways in life, justice. They're the ones that taught the people. So their role is a role that is tied with living the proper life. So that was the reason why contact with the dead would be, it's nothing, you know, mystical, impurity, this or that. It's merely to show that this is not the role that they are here for. But animals, their death is used in human life, so it's not a contra. It's not a problem.
I see.
Such an amazing system.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just so amazing.
It's surprising because I sense that myself too a lot of times. Like, wow, there's always an answer. It's just because it's so different than what human beings can do. We can't create a system like this, and we're just saying, hey, this is real. It's amazing. It's amazing.
And the subtleties too.
Yeah. Yeah, like Rabbi Chait said, he said once that the majority of a person's Torah learning is after they're dead. Meaning, when we're living, we learn, we try to, you know, take advantage of study as much as possible. But we're still limited in terms of what we can study because everything has to go through the senses. So a person shouldn't, and the rabbis also, they look forward to the state of existence after the physical world on earth, because that state was now going to be where they were even more involved in the beautiful ideas that they had here. So it's something which they actually anticipated it. So we really have to use the time properly to gain what we can and to make the inroads and the training of the mind and see the fundamentals. At the same time, we're very fortunate that, you know, we know that motive is something which is human, so we can't impute motive on God. It just doesn't work that way. And it's not for us to get an answer, you know, what man, why does man exist? Maimonides says, all we can say is that it's God's will. But it definitely is a chesed. It's definitely a great kindness that God did to create man, because man didn't always exist. And God gains nothing from our existence. So what we're forced to say is just, it's purely an act of kindness that he gives us existence and the potential to see these ideas and to have an eternity of enjoyment if we live properly. I mean, it's just like an amazing thing. It's like telling a person, I'm going to give you all the money you want, whenever you want, forever. So, but here you're doing it on a much different level. So it has to be, you know, a lot of gratitude that we have. Interesting, huh?
Yeah.
Very much so.
Yeah. All right, so maybe we'll wrap it up at this point. And again, any questions, anything during the week, feel free to call or drop an email. But So we'll be picking up the class, though, 2 weeks from today.
Okay.
2 weeks from today, okay. Unless it changes, let me know. I'll be around next week in case it changes.
Okay. Rabbi, thanks. This is very interesting.
Okay, my pleasure as always.
Appreciate it.
And feel good, Doug. I hope you start to, you know, it's a tough time, so, you know, feel free to call whatever, anything I do.
Thank you, Rabbi. I appreciate it very much.
Okay.
You have a great week.
Okay, you too.
Be well.
Okay, you too.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
All right, so I'll wrap it up for today. JHS and Josh and New York will pick up 2 weeks from today. All right, same time, 11:15 New York time. All right, so be well, and good to see everybody. Mm-hmm.